excellent, I think. Most people in, I think. I've got 8 o'clock here. Maybe I'll just wait for a minute, just out of kindness. You know what it's like sometimes, that you get yourself ready and then the last few minutes you have to go to the toilet or you forget something. The last thing I want is for people to stress out in a place like this. It's a bit strange, isn't it? The whole idea of stressing out on a retreat centre. It's a place where you can relax. And then the opportunity for meditation happens. So, okay, I think we can maybe start now the first real talk, morning talk of the retreat. And, of course, when we are talking about meditation, you've got to go to the basics. Where do you start the first steps of meditation? I was going to talk about the posture, but before you even have the posture is what you do the 5 minutes or 10 minutes before you come to meditate. In other words, you're rushing around and trying to fix up all the last-minute details, whether you're helping out in the kitchen or your own personal stuff in your room. If you're rushing around, then it does take a long time for the mind and the body to relax and settle down. So, please understand there's a speed limit in this Jhana Grove Retreat Centre. And I don't mean with your wheelchair. Or I don't mean just with your cars. I just mean just walking and just even moving the body. Almost see if it can be in sort of slow motion. But not forced slow motion. If it gets into the forced slow motion, it's just another form of control. Later on, we'll be talking about the walking meditation in these three halls next to us here. This is specially a designed retreat centre for Buddhist meditation. It wasn't designed for anything else. So a blank sheet of paper, how can we make this work for having beautiful retreats? And that's why we have the walking meditation rooms right next to the main meditation hall. So sometimes what people do is they sit here and their legs get a bit stiff and they go into the walking meditation halls. And you walk on the red carpets. See the red? There's a few red carpets are missing now. They're going to be yellow. But anyway, the red carpets there in order to try and encourage people to actually do the walking meditation. And it's across the room. Because otherwise, human nature is really strange. Sometimes if you didn't have any carpets on that room over there, what would happen is somebody would decide that it's too short, so they go diagonally. Which means that no one else could use that walking meditation room. That's just what happens. So that encourages people just to walk the right directions in the walking meditation rooms. So they walk there and they come back here and they sit meditation and they go and walk. So it's convenient to have your walking meditation rooms right next to where we sit down. And one of the reasons for doing that is one of these monks which I met when I was in Thailand, years and years and years ago. And he was a very simple villager. He was just happening to go into one of the cities in Thailand, and it was the time there was a big cremation ceremony, and the cremation ceremony of this famous forest monk called Ajahn Mun. And he just went inside to have a look and see what was happening and listen to some of the talks. One of the talks he heard was a very simple talk. And all he remembered, being a simple villager, was just, if you're going to meditate, walk a lot and sit a lot. That's all. And so he was quite inspired. He decided to become a monk. And that was his practice. Hardly anything else. One of these simple forest monasteries, he just, on his walking meditation path, he'd walk, and when he got tired, he just sit on the walking meditation path. And after he came out of meditation, he just carry on walking. That's what he did most of the day, just walk and sit, walk and sit, walk and sit. And without hardly any other instructions. There's very few monks who I, you know, can say just probably fully enlightened. And he was one of them. Such a very simple teaching. It's walk a lot, sit a lot, walk a lot, sit a lot. And he was a very powerful monk. And one of the stories over there that when he went to see him, he was talking with one of the other monks. He said, "Where you come from, Australia? Where's that?" Because these are monks who hadn't even been out of the northeast of Thailand. "Where is Australia?" He said, "Oh, it's down south." "You mean, no, like south of Bangkok?" "Yeah, quite a long way south of Bangkok." "Oh, what's down there?" And the monk gave a very quick description of geography. "If you go even further than Australia, you get to Antarctica. What's that like?" "Oh, it's got lots of ice and lots of snow." "Oh, that's interesting." And the following morning, we went to see the monk. The monk said, "Oh, yeah, you're right." "What do you mean, we're right?" He said, "Oh, yeah, there's lots of snow. It's really freezing cold down there." "How do you know?" Because he went down there the night before. This Thai monk, you know, using his powers. I can say things about monks' powers only after they're dead. But, you know, describing what it's like down there. So he was a really wonderful monk. And the nicest thing about him, well, not one, nicest, but one of the wonderful things about him was just how he practiced. Just so incredibly simply. Just walk a lot and sit a lot. And just don't aspire for things. Don't try and get things. Don't want things. So you can actually relax and come into this present moment. So anyway, before you even sit down, see if you can, 10 minutes before the meditation session, or 10 minutes, you know, after you get up, just have some breakfast, get your stuff all together, and then just 5 or 10 minutes before you come in here, just relax. Don't go thinking about things. Don't go trying to fit last things into the last few minutes. So actually, when you come in here, you're already slowing down. In the old days when you had cars, or me, myself, if you never had a car but had a motorbike, you had to go down the gears. You can't just suddenly put on the brakes and stop. That's very, very hard on the vehicle. You know, you go from fourth gear to third gear to second gear to first gear, and then you stop. You stop slowly and gently. Same way with your body and mind. Stop slowly and gently before you come to meditate. Over the days on this retreat, you'll find you go more and more slowly. But it's not just physical slowness. Of course, the mind starts to stop thinking so much. And even your cognitive processes start to calm down and slow down, which makes it easier to bring to more of a stop when you're meditating. So give yourself that time, be patient. And when you do sit down to meditate, we have chairs here as well as the mats, and there's cushions, there's heaps of cushions all over the place. I don't mind you borrowing the cushions from your rooms as long as you take them back again afterwards. And the point is that enough cushions to get your body to be as comfortable as you possibly can. And if sitting on the cushions is difficult for you, there's these chairs which we have. So sit on those chairs to be comfortable. And sometimes people, if you're not used to sitting on the ground, it's, you know, you can maybe sit for an hour, but then later on in the afternoon you get very stiff. So, you know, alternate between chairs and the cushions on the floor. The most important thing is so your body is at ease and comfortable. If there is any aches and pains in the body, I look upon that as like business to be attended to. It's my like legs are just saying, "I need to be scratched." Or my bottom is saying, "Look, I'm really uncomfortable, please move me." It's business. It's work. And we come on this retreat to settle all our business so that we can attend to inside of us, inside our mind. So we have to settle the body first of all. And it's not just preparation. You all know if you're a gardener, it's preparing the soil is the hardest work before you plant things in that soil. If you're a builder, it's putting the foundations in is the most hardest to work. If you're a decorator, you're putting the paint on with the brush, that's the easy part. It's the preparation of the wall beforehand which takes all the time. It's the same with much of life, even meditation. It's a preparation. What you do at the beginning is really, really, really important. So you prepare your body, nice bit of exercise. If anyone wants to do yoga or qigong or not kung fu, I don't think that's a good thing to do. If you want to do something just to exercise the body, that's fine. Go for a walk, even a bit of jogging, fine. So get your body nice and relaxed, fit, sort of healthy, as best you can. And then you sit it in a comfortable position. Now, I'm going to introduce a word straight away here, which I will repeat many, many times. For those people who don't know this word, it's a Pali word, and it's called Gomayang. Go is a word for like a cow, especially like a male cow, because it's got the male ending there, go. So it's like a bull. Go means bull. Mayang is what comes out of the backside of a bull. S-H-I-T. So it's not very nice to say bullshit all the time. Mm-hmm. So instead I'm more refined to say the Pali word, go mayang. So sometimes people say that your posture is really, really important. You've got to sit, you know, maybe in full lotus with your back straight, with your right hand over, not the left hand over the right hand over the left hand. And all that sort of stuff is a lot of Gomayang. And of course, that is not just from my knowledge of how the Buddha taught, his knowledge of how Ajahn Chah taught, but also out of personal experience. That sometimes you get into the best meditations in the most weird postures. It's like your body is saying, put your posture in this way. So that's not in any book, but the body says, do it this way. And I listen to my body now, and I find out that there you get the best meditation because your body is relaxed. The most important part of the body posture is the relaxation. So that's one of the reasons why that we try and look after our body. You say, well, why don't we all lay down on the ground? You'll know the answer because you'll go to sleep. And personally, I can sit still for much longer like this, cross-legged on a cushion, than I can laying down on a bed. Laying down on a bed, you always turn this way, turn that way, because the beds aren't that comfortable sometimes. But sitting down cross-legged, you can sit for hours sometimes. So sometimes you find that posture which is the best for you. So you can cross your legs any way you wish. Now, in some traditions, especially the Thai tradition which I was brought up in, they would always tell you, please don't put your feet out because you'll point them at the Buddha or point them at a monk or point them at a nun. But then sometimes people say, well, which way can you put your feet? There's Buddhas all over the place. Almost anywhere you point your feet, there'll be a Buddha there somewhere in these monasteries with so many Buddhas, or nuns or monks. So that's not the point. Now, you're not doing this out of disrespect. You're respecting your body, respecting your kindness. So respecting the practice of kindness and learning how to relax the body. So the body eventually can just become nice and loose and relax. So for those of you who have listened to me doing guided meditations before, you know that I always start, and this is how I start my meditation as well, in personal, in private, just checking my posture before I begin. Because with your eyes closed, you can be much more sensitive to how your body feels. That's one of the reasons why we close our eyes in meditation. It increases the focus of your awareness on your body, so it's not distracted on so many different things. It's why when we have a meditation hall like this, we keep it as boring as possible. This is on purpose. We don't have too many signs all over the place. We don't have paintings on the wall. We don't have too many knickknacks on the shrine. Keep it simple so there's not much to look at. For those of you who looked at the precepts, you've got like 8 precepts, not using adornments or attractive clothing. In other words, not doing anything which brings people's attention outside of their own body and mind onto something else. You keep it simple. So when you close your eyes, that's one of the five senses you don't have to be bothered with. It's one, like if you imagine like five mobile phones, that's one phone which is turned off. So you're not disturbed by it. So you close your eyes, and the other next sense, which is the most, one of the most difficult to turn off, is this body. And this body, sometimes, if you want to understand what I mean, sometimes have a look. Somebody was just scratching their nose. Somebody is just moving their legs. Someone is just adjusting their shawl on them. Someone lifting their head up. What I'm seeing. We always move. We move so much, we scratch this, we move that, we cough, we eyelids just go up and down. We do that, we do it all the time, we don't realise, just adjusting our glasses, we don't realise, scratching our nose, how much this body disturbs us. We got used to it. So we start with our body, with your eyes closed. We do what they call the body scan. Now, most body scans, or other monks, nuns, teachers, they usually do the body scan from the head down to the legs. And I thought that's a silly way of doing it because, you know, the head and this part of the body, is so much going on there. I always prefer to do the simple first and build up the energy so that once you get to places like your body, your mindfulness is really quite strong. And your ability to be kind and relax things is also pretty strong. So I always start with my legs. I develop mindfulness of my feet. And it's a strange thing to say this, but again, it originates from my teacher Ajahn Chah. Because over in the forests, the jungles of Thailand, you know, we hardly ever wore sandals or shoes. We couldn't have them. They weren't what people had. It's a very poor monastery in a poor place of Thailand, 50 years ago in the northeast of Thailand. So you'd always be walking barefoot everywhere, which was okay, but there were so many roots and pebbles and stuff, you know, in the jungle. And you know, we'd always be scratching, you know, have scratches on our feet or wounds on our feet. We managed to find some Band-Aids. So Ajahn Chah saw these Western monks, all this Band-Aid here and Band-Aid there, and like we'd been in some car accident. He said, what's going on there? So just, you know, barefoot, we're not used to it, and we keep sort of treading on things. And that's where Ajahn Chah said, you Westerners, you may think you're smart, but you've got stupid feet. And the whole idea of having stupid feet, I never had those, the part of the body, the feet, and stupidity sort of joined together before, but how true it was. Our feet were very dumb. And so soon you learn how to have clever feet. In other words, you could actually feel, you know, where you were stepping to make sure it was safe. And it was really helpful, because I remember even one time stepping on a snake. And now, it was in one of those little places, opening the door of your hut, and the snake was just in that blind spot, just next to the door, but I was looking a bit far past that snake. And so because I had sensitive feet, you could feel like something cold there, and I sort of, instead of stepping down, I could just touch it and then just jumped up. So the snake wasn't harmed at all. I remember afterwards, these little anecdotes, this was in the north of Thailand, in this little room, the snake was there. The snake was terrified of me, as I was scared of the snake. We'd looked at each other, and I said, "I'm sorry." I said, I speak to snakes. Give them loving kindness. May you be happy and well." And the little snake, you could see the expression on its face just relaxing a little bit, and it could actually slither slowly out the door. So then, that's when you get sensitive. I could actually, if I wasn't sensitive to my feet, then I wouldn't have noticed what I was stepping on and squashed it and it would have bitten me. That might have been the end of me. But the sensitivity to the feet, you start this when you're meditating. Like even now, don't look at your feet. Can you feel them? How are they? Just saying, how are you, feet, is actually connecting to them. In other words, it's becoming mindful of them. And in neuroscience, the more times you establish that connection to something like your feet, the more that you create that neural connection, and the easier it is to become mindful of them the next time. You develop that awareness. And you just move up from your feet to your ankles, ankles to your calves, calves to your knees, knees to your thighs. You sweep up the body little by little as you're aware of your body. And as you are aware of the body, if you come across the body saying, look, I'm in a bad position, that I'm not going to be able to maintain some comfort like this, then of course you move. It's a kindness. The mindfulness is there to get the data, get the information, and the kindness reacts appropriately. And you find if you follow just simple things like mindfulness and kindness on your body, it's amazing just how your body can relax much deeper than you ever thought possible. And the mind does have some power. You don't have to be years and years meditating to have that power. Each person does have that power. But be aware, keep your awareness there for a while, and just give it this wonderful sense of kindness, which relaxes things, which takes away people's pain. I don't know if there's any, there are a few nurses in that profession here on this retreat. Now, nurses were incredible, wonderful people, especially when they had time, just to sit next to somebody who was sick and even like hold their hand or just talk to them and just show their kindness. And it's the kindness which is one of the greatest of the therapies. It's been a long time since I was in hospital, but it's amazing. One of the things I remember there was being woken up in the middle of the night to take some medication, because I was supposed to have a test the following morning. And this nurse, just now standing on the bed, I just woke up, just smiling. I thought it was like in a dream, like some angel, because that's the perception which I remember from that experience. This beautiful kindness coming down from this being, waking me up, asking me to drink something, and then they can go back to sleep again. And that kindness is incredibly powerful. And of course, you all know my stories of my memories of my own mother, poor upbringing, but spending a lot of time playing soccer in the streets. And you can imagine playing soccer in the streets of London, just went for a tackle on the ground, but it wasn't grass, it was like bitumen or stone pavement. So you'd injure your knees. I always remember scraping the skin off my knees and spending so many parts of my youth with scabs, dried blood on the knees, because what my mum would do, she would just kneel down and she would kiss it. And it was weird. A mouth with all its germs on an open wound. But it never got infected. And as soon as she gave her that bit of kindness, all of the pain vanished. Thank you, Mum. And she put a Band-Aid on it without really cleaning it. Being kissed, that's good enough. And then off I was playing soccer again, as a young kid, just enjoying. But the kindness there was something I always remembered. And later on, doing a bit of science, how on earth did that work? The kindness was the most incredible part of taking away the aches and the pains and relaxing that wound. And of course, my mother passed away quite a while ago now. But I can still give kindness to my own body. Of course, it's very hard for me with this up here to kiss my knee. I won't even try it. But you just have a look at it and just give this beautiful energy. Me, I do care for you. Even like as I'm doing now, just giving a little bit of a massage. And you find that takes away a lot of the pain. So what you're doing here is awareness and kindness to relax all these parts of the body. And when you do this for long enough, you find it's very simple to take the part of the body which feels a bit sick, or actually is sick, and relax it just so fully, the sickness vanishes. And of course you've heard many of my stories of being in difficult situations, and using that kindness and mindfulness to actually just overcome physical problems. Like the one anecdote, you've heard all my anecdotes before, I'm sure, but the anecdote for when I was over in South Korea a few years ago and doing a 2 or 3 day meditation retreat up in this ski resort up in the mountains. And it was really cold outside, I think minus 16 or 17 degrees outside. It was snowing, snow everywhere. So you went outside there to, they wanted us to do a walk or something in the snow. And after doing the walk, got a cold. A real cold. You know, the eyes were watering and the stuff was coming out of your nose. And of course, a sensible person would just take a rest. But I had an interview that afternoon on national TV, live. What are you going to do when you got all this liquid coming out of your nose? I didn't have any medication, and sometimes I don't like taking medication. Don't know what's really in it, but also there's another way you can make use of your meditation experience. It's nothing sort of psychic or supernatural. You just put your awareness on your sinuses, which is where the main irritation could be felt. And be kind to it. Relax it to the max. Just in the present moment, not worrying about time or how much time you had or didn't have, because that would have stopped the process working. It's so lovely. Half an hour, the cold had gone. There's nothing coming out of my eyes or my mouth or my nose. Everything had relaxed to the max and there was no problem anymore. I've seen that so many times, that how this can actually do a huge amount of healing, which is one of the reasons why you do teach it at cancer groups and other groups and use it yourself. It's wonderful mindfulness and kindness. So anyway, you do that. And I say that to you because it encourages you to do this and to learn this for your health and well-being, but in particular with your body, with your beginning of meditation. So you go right through the body. When you come up through your torso, there's so much stuff going on there. That's where all these organs are. And it's very easy for those organs to go wrong or eat the wrong thing or some little cancer or something growing in that part of your body, whatever. Whenever you scan your attention through the body, if you find any part of that body which feels, the best word I can say is this, unbalanced, something not quite normal. You can't really explain many of the physical sensations because we just don't have vocabulary for it. When you go through that part of the body, it feels a bit unbalanced. Whatever word you use, just pause there. Focus in or zoom in on that area as best you can and just give as much kindness as you can possibly give it. The door of my heart's open to you. Tumor, cold, pain. Don't try to get rid of it. That's a mistake many people make, you know, trying to be a control freak on your body. It's different than being a control freak. It's understanding this imbalance there, being kind to it, and just watching it balance itself. And just observe it, just get quite healthy again. And of course, you know, there's so many examples of this. That, again, one which comes to mind, this guy in Penang came to see me because he's had this very weird disease in his brain. He said his brain was actually just all tangled up. I think it was a very rare condition. Only two or three people in the world apparently had it. Well, not more than that, I think. Only two or three people in that part of Asia. But he said the only way to fix it up, the tangled blood vessels or whatever, neural connections, was have an operation, which was very painful. But he decided to have the operation a few years before he met me, and then he was okay. But then it came back again. He had remission. And that really scared him, because he knew what it would feel like. But then in the meantime, he'd gotten married, and his wife was pregnant with the first child. And he said, I know this is really going to hurt, but I have to do this for my kid. So he went, it was a hospital in Singapore, was one of the few places which could do this operation. So he got all ready for it. They had to put him in this like steel cage to stop him threshing around or whatever. But they gave him the CT scan first of all. And the specialist came back, oh, there's something wrong with our machine, we have to do the scan again. I often say, if you go to have a scan with a doctor and they say that, yay! Because it's usually very good news. So he went to have his second scan, they came back and said, we don't need to do the operation. It's fixed itself up by itself. Well done. And of course he was just so happy about that. And the reason why he'd fixed it up itself was because he came to see me 6 months before. Ajahn Brahm, help. I don't want to go through this operation, but I must. Any other possibilities? And I sort of taught him simple meditations, and it worked. So he came back up to Penang and said, thank you, Ajahn Brahm. It worked. He didn't need the operation. So, mindfulness and kindness. I've seen it too many times work and do miracles, not real miracles, it's you're healing yourself. And so you're doing this to relax your body, but also getting to know your body, how it works, and how little things like kindness, it's actually not a little thing, it's a huge thing. You learn how to be kind. And of course that sometimes people say, well, Ajahn Brahm, what is kindness? And this is actually how you can improve your understanding of the meaning of that word and how powerful it is by putting on some sort of ache or wound in your body and just learning just what the kindness is, because when it really is working, everything relaxes so deeply. And even now, just sitting, everything can relax so amazingly. You get to the point of having finished a body scan and being able to sit delightfully. This is the word which, you know, I like to focus on a lot in this retreat, the delight of relaxation, the delight of deep meditation. You know that some time ago, when first time I started talking about the deep meditations, and that even when you start watching your breathing, the breathing becomes delightful. In those days, I called it beautiful breath. Watch the the beautiful breath. But then again, you know, after many years, to say that, that's a word, beautiful. It's not really a visual experience, but it's just noticing the pleasure of just breathing in at a certain stage of meditation. This is when you start to experience piti sukha, as the Buddha said, with your breath. And at other stages of the meditation as well. And this is what you do when you start to relax the body. You get joy up in your own body. You can feel it, the delightful feeling of a relaxed body. And it's one of the reasons why people go into hot baths or they get a massage. Or they go to these spas. So this is not just Club Med Serpentine. This is Bodhinyana Spa Serpentine, where your body just really relaxes and feels really nice. That's what my body does when I come here and meditate. It feels just so nice and it's just so beautiful. feels delightful, almost tingly. And that's a sign that you're relaxing. When that happens, that becomes the object of my meditation. Whatever's the most prominent thing happening right now is what I watch. And that becomes the delight of a relaxed body. And that makes my body even more relaxed. So relaxed that, again, it's not a problem for me now. The business has been done, the job has been done. And then you can let the body disappear. In that preliminary exercise, you've developed this awareness of physical feelings in the body. For those people who are scholars, it's like a first satipatthana of knowing the body. Knowing actually how to let that body vanish. It's also a little bit of the second satipatthana of Vedana. We're noticing the joy of the body, the piti sukha come up, and how that can relax everything so much that this body can just be put aside for a while. But it's the main thing which you're doing is you're learning just how to be aware. Because when you're aware of the body, a lot of people can't find a conversation about the body. About Buddhism, about Dharma, about philosophy, oh, you can think for hours on that one. But actually a pain in the body, it's just there, it doesn't create a conversation. So it actually tends to stop a lot of this thinking and the feeling of experiencing and not trying to describe it. And especially when it gets delightful, it means you can relax there. It draws you in. There's two ways of focusing on something. One is you decide to focus on it and you use your willpower. Focus. The other way, which is far more effective and longer lasting, is it becomes so delightful you can't take your eyes off it. If ever you... It's maybe sitting in the evening, I forget what time sunset is right now, whether it's, oh, it should be before the evening talk. But sometimes you can sit out there having a cup of tea just watching the sunset. And do you have to really focus on the sunset? Just say, I've got to watch the sunset. Now come on, don't have a wandering mind, come on, watch the sunset. Often the sunset is so beautiful, so attractive, you can't stop watching it. It draws you in, its delight, its beauty. It's a cause of your stillness and focus. And that's exactly how the meditation works. The delight of a relaxed body means you don't want to move. And then you go inside your mind. And the delight of a tranquil mind. Oh, that's gorgeous. So once you start getting delight in your meditation, then you can sit for hours. And why? Having a wonderful time. How long does it take? How long can you watch, well, there's a few Sri Lankans here, how long can you watch a cricket match for? How long can you meditate? Ooh, maybe I can watch a cricket match a bit longer. Or a movie. Or I don't know what else you know, people like to watch or listen to. If it's delightful, it keeps your attention there. You don't have to focus on it. The focus happens naturally. So encouraging and generating that delight in meditation is important. So what we do next in our meditation, your body is tranquil. Now your mind, and again, what is this mind we're supposed to be looking at? Oh, you get the 5 senses of seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, touch, and the 6th sense of knowing, the mind. But for many people, when you start to talk about the mind, you start with philosophy or dogma, religious dogma, ideas. What is this mind? But it's much easier to do something like noticing one of the faculties of the mind, one of its characteristics. How peaceful, how agitated is it? Simple thing. It's peace or agitation. that emotional qualities, they define what this mind is. Like I often say, like the stars or the moon define what the sky is and what space is. That's how people recognize it. So for your mind, it's how peaceful is it? Or how agitated? So I encourage meditators, once the body has been relaxed, then to start to relax the mind, just by noticing its level of peace or agitation. What I sort of started asking people to notice and call it the peaceometer. How peaceful are you right now? It's something you can be aware of, something you can know. And the more times you do it, look at how peaceful you are, and even giving a number from 1 to 10, because that's what we do in our culture, give it numbers. But at least it gives you an idea how peaceful you are. You are looking at your mind. And once you can start to see one of its essential qualities, how peaceful it is, the next thing you learn is how that mind becomes more peaceful, how it becomes agitated. What stirs you up? What tranquilizes you? And these are such important things to learn, how to be peaceful. And it's very simple, very, very simple answers. So simple, I've said it many times before, you've experienced it yourself before. It's first of all in the present moment, because the future and the past, they are just, actually they're so unworthy of your attention. You don't get anywhere by planning things out. There's one of my little sayings, every time I don't make plans for the future, after a while things go wrong. When I don't make plans for the future. When I do make plans for the future, they go wrong anyway. Either way it goes wrong. So I decide to enjoy myself by making no plans before it all goes wrong. That way you're realizing it actually goes wrong less when you don't make plans, because you're attending to this present moment, the place where your future is being made. Right now, this is it. Look after this moment with kindness and you have a wonderful future, much better than otherwise would have been. A few plans later on, but not that many. We plan way too much. And the past is also a fabrication which we make. What we think happened probably didn't happen. Simple things. Like, what did you have for breakfast this morning? Are you sure? Yeah, I'm sure, but it's amazing. Sometimes when people actually, we play those little tricks and you know, we see what you had for breakfast, that is that what you really had? Sometimes you get it wrong. Your memory is unreliable on simple things. That's only this morning. You go back earlier and it's really unreliable. Because of that, don't give your memory too much value. And don't be controlled or hindered or being put in prison by your memory. It's a lovely way of letting the past go. And of course, when you're meditating, just no past, no future, just sitting here, you find there you get very peaceful. You don't have to remember the past. You do not learn from the past nearly as much as you learn from the present. This is where the wisdom lies. And the future, see what happens. But right now, put your attention to just what's happening now. So relax body, and in this moment, and when you really get into this moment, you get into what we call the silence. Magical silence, the stillness of the mind. Where you don't give anything a name. What are names anyway? You know, sometimes it's difficult to explain even like feelings in your body to a doctor. You're sick, I'm in pain. You know, what type of pain? I don't know. Sometimes the doctor says, well, explain it to me. Well, you say, well, you know, I touch my head, my forehead, it hurts. Touch my nose, it hurts. Touch my chin, it hurts. I touch my breast, it hurts. I touch my knees, it hurts. The doctor said, I know the reason why. You've got a broken finger. Oh, come on, it's allowed to laugh. It's a joke, but it's a nice joke. But our ability to describe physical feelings is really limited. So imagine how limited our description of our internal world, of our mind is. That's a help. Because you can't really give it a name, it means you can't get a conversation about it. You know you can feel. This is peaceful. This is delightful. It only explains a tiny fraction of it. You don't need to explain it, but you need to feel it, to know it. And let it be. And you realize that the more you try and interfere and control it and own it, the more you will disturb it. One of the anecdotes where I learned this was when I mentioned yesterday, when I did in 1972, I was actually 1973, go to India, 72, 73, anyway, around that time, because I was a Buddhist already, I thought I should go on pilgrimage, why not? So off I went, by myself, totally disorganized. But I had another goal. When I went to India, I saw these photographs in the books of the Himalaya Mountains. Oh, they were so impressive. I thought, that's one of the things I want to do before I become a monk or, you know, stop traveling. I want to see the Himalaya Mountains. So I had a camera with me. I took over to India. And when I got there, I think it was in July. Monsoon season. Where are the Himalaya Mountains? They're over there behind the clouds. They were just totally obscured by these really thick clouds. And just waiting 3 days, 4 days, 5 days, they weren't going to clear. Locals said no way they're going to clear till maybe sort of October or sometime. By that time, I'm supposed to be back in UK. So I just gave up. But then one day, I was in Kathmandu, and we heard that the post office there, they had a delivery up to the border with mainland China, way up north of Nepal, on the border with Tibet. And, you know, you weren't really supposed to sit in the back of the postal van, but if you gave a few rupees to the driver, of course you can go in. So I went up there with two other Americans, a couple. And when we got close to the border, the driver stopped for lunch. So, you know, we didn't really want anything to eat. But there was a hill, so we climbed the hill. And as soon as we got to the top of the hill, it was like magic. The monsoon clouds parted. And you could see the whole range of the Himalaya Mountains. Oh, it was breathtaking. It's gorgeous. So what did I do? I didn't have my camera. So I ran down the hillside as fast as I could. But I ran up again, and I could run in those days, not like today. I was really thin and fit. And then I ran down, got my camera, ran back up again. It took about 20 minutes, half an hour, to get down and back up again. And as soon as I got back up, I could just see the clouds close up again. It was almost like something was teaching me a lesson. And the two Americans said, well, where did you go to? It's a magnificent, for half an hour, see all this incredible range of the Himalaya Mountains. Where did you go? Oh no, that's absolutely accurate. It was one of the goals of going to India at that time, to see those mountains and get a camera shot off them, but of course I missed out on both. Mm-hmm. It's like something was teaching me a lesson. You can't capture beauty. You can experience it, but you can't take a photograph of it. In meditation, you can't capture just all those wonderful experiences. Enjoy it and let them go. Otherwise, they'll never even come to you. So thank you for that experience. It's like the heavenly beings did that on purpose. I often thought they did it on purpose to teach me a lesson. At least I realized this is how you meditate. See, beautiful experience in meditation. Don't try and capture it. Let it be. So you're in this moment, not thinking, not trying to capture anything. Relaxing to the max. You're making peace. And it's at that time that in my meditation, as I teach others, this is where your breath starts to appear. Usually your breath. Breath is one of the most common types of meditation object. And it happens because it's the only thing left moving. Everything else has disappeared. There's many people tell me that they did breath meditation before, like I did before, just choosing to watch the breath. And if it's not there, come on, breathe. I'm just really getting myself stressed out again. But now I realize that that's not the way to do breath meditation. To do breath meditation, you really relax till the breath is the only thing left moving. And then when you see it, it's always delightful. Breath comes in, breath goes out. The nearest simile you can give is like the simile of going to the beach alone and seeing on a very calm day, seeing just the waves just come up the shore and then just go back again. You know you can't control them. You know you can't say, come in long, come in short. This is the ocean decides that. Nature decides. All you just do is watch. It's a delightful thing to do. You're not thinking. You're not fantasizing. Because just the sound of the waves coming up and going down again. Not the waves, but just, you know, the ocean coming up and ebbing away again. It's delightful enough. You don't need to add to it. You can only disturb it. Or like, because I used to, before I became a monk, like listening to classical music. In classical music, you cannot just tell someone sitting next to you how beautiful it is, because you're disturbing the next notes which are coming. Just be in this present moment. One of the delights of classical music, you're always in this present moment if you listen to it properly. You're silent inside. You can't say anything. If you're saying something to yourself, you're not listening to the music. So little by little, you learn how to appreciate these moments. When the breath comes up, it's delightful. It's easy to watch. So many people, you talk about breath meditation, anapanasati, and they try and force their mind onto the breath. And they come up and say, I can't do breath meditation. I said, you're not doing it correctly. Get the body peaceful and relaxed. Get the mind relaxed and peaceful. And it's the easiest thing in the world to watch the breath. Can you watch the waves of the ocean come up and go back again on a calm day? Of course you can. It's wonderful to see. Can you watch a sunset? Of course you can. It's as easy it is to watch the breath. Just sitting here and it comes and goes and it's beautiful. And of course that's only the start of the meditation. But just to get to that point of just being able to sit here delightfully watching a breath come in, watching it going out again, with the body nicely relaxed, with in this moment, present moment, not having any thoughts about anything at all. You get used to this delight of just watching a breath go in and go out, and that is incredibly satisfying, health-producing, relaxing, stress-annihilating, for want of a better word, and you're starting to do meditation. It feels peaceful. In fact, I remember the first meditation which I ever did for 5 minutes. I just remember this so well. This was 50 years ago at least, in the Wordsworth room of King's College in Cambridge. It's only a small room. But there, just meditating for 5 minutes. That was how much we were being taught to meditate. Always feeling, wow, this is really peaceful. It hooked me straight away, like being hooked on heroin, but something much better, on peace. and the path to peace created by this meditation. Such a long journey in those 50 years, sometimes trying to recreate that peace on purpose, using willpower, thinking, I am strong enough, I'm smart enough, I can do this. Until after many years, you realize that you can't do it. None of you here can meditate. You have to get out of the way to let meditation happen. Disappearing. Body vanishing, relaxed. In this moment, no willpower. It's like you're disappearing. You're just a watcher, observing. You're not doing anything. Most of who you think you are, most of the day, is gone. And afterwards, if you ever get a deep meditation, wow, how did that happen? I said, who did that? And he said, it wasn't me. I'm not responsible, not me, I didn't do it. Don't blame me. You got out of the way. You were peaceful and still and observed this magic of your mind. And how delightful and joyful and powerful it gets after good meditation. And that's the other last little thing before as I finish off. As you develop more and more meditation like this, more and more peace, more and more stillness, you'll find it's like you're waking up. Like you've been in a dullness. And don't dismiss, I'm not talking about sloth and torpor where you're half asleep. I'm talking about when you think you're awake. You're only picking up a fraction of what's happening to you and around the world and what's being said and how it's being said. But as you meditate more and more, you get alive. They have my favorite suttas, Nalakapana Sutta. And there it says the only way to overcome these five hindrances and discontent and weariness is to develop the deep meditations. I like that sutta where it adds on these other two qualities, arati, which is like discontent, not liking stuff. One of the causes of depression. And weariness, the tiredness. So many people feel tired in their life, worn out. It's not physical. It's the fact that their mindfulness has just got so weak. And when you meditate, it is like you're waking up. You can experience the sunsets with more beauty. And even, it's another thing which often say, the food which is brought here tastes more delicious than the best 5-star restaurants in Perth. That shocked me when I first discovered that. When the first lay meditation retreat which I did, the food was delicious. And I couldn't understand why. Because it's cooked by student boarding house cooks. Which in chef's abilities was the lowest of the pile. Cooks who couldn't get a job anywhere else could maybe get some work feeding poor students. But where I went, on this retreat I did, the food was delicious. I thought it's maybe just got a really good cook. No, it wasn't a cook at all. It was the fact that my mindfulness had increased so much through the meditation practice that whatever tiny remnant of flavour was left out of all that boiling, you could actually pick up. So I didn't understand at the time, but you understand now. Your mindfulness increases in power. You realize that's really important to do meditation. It's not your willpower which is needed to be increased. It's your mindfulness power. So what you perceive, what you see, what you feel, what you taste becomes more full. So when you start, I don't know what you're having for lunch today, when that first spoon of rice goes in your mouth. It blows your mind with just how incredibly tasty that is today. You can really fully appreciate the soft texture of the rice and its flavor. Like you've never tasted a spoon of rice ever before, that delicious. Then you know your mindfulness is increasing. And how much fun that is. Well, I'll finish off with, I don't usually take much rice, but one of my favourite cuisines, I'm surprised, it's something I like, is actually quite healthy for you, for a change, is baked beans. Believe it or not, it's supposed to be quite good for you. But anyway, remember, just after doing, not this personal retreat, but a personal retreat a couple of years ago, and just after the retreat, just really, you know, up in the heavens somewhere, my mind, just having to eat, and putting, instead of a spoon of baked beans in my mouth, just one bean, just a single one. They're not very big, you know, the baked beans. Just one bean, put it in your mouth, and just, that really blew my mind. Just how tasty it was. Just one bean. And the texture of a bean, which is, you know, not hard, not soft. It just like fragmented in my mouth as I sort of squashed it. And the flavour just went right through my palate and right into my brain and my mind, delighting it to the max. And just one bean took, a tiny little bean this big, that took about 2 or 3, 4, 5 minutes to finish with. Not because I was trying to hold it, it just, you hadn't finished with it. It was so delightful and so tasty. And the balance of flavours there, you know, they have the tomato sauce on the outside or whatever it's called, and that was in a little bit acidic but sweet at the same time, a tiny bit of saltiness in there, and you could taste everything. And it was just like it had been perfectly balanced by some 5-star chef. But the baked beans came out of a Heinz can. That's what it came from. It tasted amazing. It was nothing to do with the chef. Everything to do with your mindfulness was so strong, you could pick up everything there, and oh, it was gorgeous. So anyway, that's what happened to you. Your food will go, oh, this is nice. Oh, who was the cook today? Can I have that recipe? I'm giving you the recipe. Nothing to do with the cook. Everything to do with your meditation. Something to look forward to. And the nature here, seeing the trees and seeing the animals and seeing everything, seeing the sky. This last night it was a little bit overcast. But anyway, sometimes you really want to bliss out after the evening talk on those stupas, lie on your back, look at the stars in the heavens. Wow. The whole Milky Way up there. Don't be an astronomer and figure out which is which and how far away they are, what they're up to and what star or planet is up tonight. Just don't go thinking. Just go feeling, enjoying. Sometimes you look up there, wow. Really strong mindfulness. You'll be out there for half an hour or more. Because it's gorgeous, it's beauty. When you do develop deep meditation or even modicum of powerful mindfulness, everything looks beautiful. And stuff which looks beautiful to ordinary people just stuns you. And enjoy. That's part of what's on offer. And it's not an obstacle at all. It's going to encourage you. Okay, I better stop talking, otherwise I'll go on forever. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. That's right. Okay, so enjoy this morning, whatever, however you make use of it. You can stay in here and meditate, go for a little bit of a walk, have a cup of tea, and go and have a rest if you need to have a rest, whatever you need to do. And your lunch is at 11 o'clock. Is that correct? Yeah, okay. And this afternoon, same, after lunch, do your chores, have a rest if you want, have a walk, do some more meditation. It's a total free afternoon, but don't push yourself. And even if you can, don't have plans. Just say what you need to do and do it. And in the evening, we have a Q&A session. So you can put questions in the box in there. It's just outside. But please just only one question per person per day, because otherwise you get so many questions there. And it's one of the things which I respect every question. I try my best to answer them, but sometimes there's so many in there, sometimes you can't give a question its full, you know, the answer it's worth, because there's too many questions afterwards. So try and keep a question which is important to you, but one a day. And I'll try my best to answer them with as much wisdom, care as I possibly can. Have a wonderful day.